This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years of craftsmanship, April 3rd through 30th. For a store location near you, you can visit www.peets.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Eddie Argo from the Portland State University Association of African Students will join us live in the studio.
This Friday at 4 p.m., Amnesty International hosts a rally at Pioneer Square to denounce torture. Reporter Aaron Ernst speaks with local Amnesty Chapter 48 founder Jane Christoph.
There won't be any criminal charges over alleged paperwork fraud by government scientists on the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste dump.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,383 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,000 civilians have been reported being killed by military intervention in Iraq. In 2004, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 25th, 2006. I'm Lori Hilliard.
And I'm Doug Guidi. State legislatures in Illinois, California, and now Vermont have introduced House resolutions to initiate impeachment proceedings against President Bush and Vice President Cheney. The Jefferson Manual of Rules for the U.S. House of Representatives allows state legislatures to initiate impeachment proceedings by submitting charges to Congress. Also in Pennsylvania, State Senator Jim Furlow is collecting signatures on petitions calling for Congress to launch an impeachment inquiry.
Sidney Lezak, the U.S. Attorney for Oregon from 1961 to 1982, has died at a Portland hospice. He was 81. The cause of death yesterday was not determined, but Lezak had been having difficulties with speech and movement. Lezak was a liberal Democrat who attempted to keep politics out of his office. In the 1960s, he balanced his opposition to the Vietnam War with his duty to prosecute draft dodgers. Lezak, when he could, got men who refused to go to war into a diversion program or sentenced to community service. President John F. Kennedy appointed Lezak U.S. Attorney in early 1961. Until a few weeks ago, he had been involved in the mediation of priest sex abuse cases against the Archdiocese of Portland.
The Christian Science Monitor reported today that an Oregon public-private coalition has been created for emergency response communications. The new system is called the Regional Alliances for Infrastructure and Network Security, or RAINS. So far, RAINS links 250 users in 9 Oregon counties, ranging from the Portland mayor's office to hotel managers and private security firms to law enforcement. The system takes incident alerts from 9-11 call centers, law enforcement, transportation agencies, police, and others, and reformats each event as a digital alert. These alerts are then sent to users via the web, cell phones, and pagers. Officials say the technology allows the dissemination of alerts that cannot be copied, stored, or printed to make sure the information doesn't go to the wrong people.
The average price of a gallon of gasoline in Oregon is still 5 cents below the record set last September, but motorists in Portland, Salem, and Vancouver, Washington are now paying record prices in their areas. The average price across Oregon Tuesday was $2.85 for a gallon of unleaded regular, according to prices tracked by Oregon-Idaho AAA. The statewide record average is $2.90, set September 9, 2005. In the past week, gasoline prices around the state jumped another 15 cents a gallon, hitting an average Tuesday of $2.82 in the Portland and Salem areas and $2.83 in Vancouver. Tuesday's average in the Eugene area was $2.90 and in Medford was $2.89.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services say two rare salamanders that live in old-growth forests along the Klamath River don't need Endangered Species Act protection. They say today that the existing state and federal protections are adequate to maintain the salamander's habitat. But environmentalists who sought the listings for the Siskiyou Mountain salamander and Scott's Bar salamander say they would challenge the decision in court. They note that moves are underway to remove both the protections cited by Fish and Wildlife. And the agency itself is embarking on a study to see just how much harm logging does to the salamander's habitat.
In Washington, the Kitsap County Prosecutor's Office has decided not to retry four protesters who were arrested last August near the main gate of the Bangor submarine base. A mistrial was declared earlier this month in Kitsap County District Court when jurors were unable to agree on a verdict. The four admitted blocking the road, but said their action posed no significant risk of injuries to others.
This weekend, Amnesty International USA hosts its annual conference on human rights in Portland. In anticipation of this event, the KBOO Evening News this week introduces you to the human rights defenders and abuse survivors working locally in Portland. For today's broadcast, reporter Aaron Ernst spoke with local Amnesty Chapter 48 founder Jane Christoph.
Amnesty International is a huge organization that has almost 2 million members in 150 countries. But although it focuses on preventing human rights abuses around the world, it's really its local volunteers that make up the core of the organization, and it's their dedication that make it so effective. Group 48 here in Portland is one such example.
We really didn't know what we were doing. We were pretty inefficient at first. We wrote letters and waited for responses before writing the second letter.
Jane Christoph teaches art history at PSU and has been with Group 48 since the very beginning in 1973 when it struggled to begin after a concert by Joan Baez.
Group 48 got down at one point to three people, of which I was one. But then we decided to meet at a Chinese restaurant, and that seemed to perk up the interest. And we've been, you know, growing and very active all these years.
Jane's husband, Chris, is originally from Romania, and he experienced human rights abuses firsthand, first under the Nazis, and then under the Soviets in World War II. He's also one of Group 48's original founders.
His home was a way station for the Polish underground, traveling between Poland and Romania. When he was home on leave, pretty much the whole family was arrested, and he spent some time in jail and was only released in order to go back to the front. Then, after the war, came the communists, and things got pretty bad there, too. So he escaped to Yugoslavia, swam the Danube and escaped to Yugoslavia, and was there interned for a couple of years. So it became pretty clear that it doesn't really matter the ideology that is oppressing you. It's oppression just the same.
Jane and Chris were both drawn to Amnesty International because of its strong dedication to neutrality.
When Amnesty was started, the fact that it was not ideological, that it helped all prisoners of conscience as long as they did not use or advocate violence, that really appealed deeply to both of us.
Amnesty uses its strong network of volunteers in order to really keep human rights abuses in the public and international eye. One way it does this is by coordinating letter-writing campaigns. They can take a long time to be effective, but they do keep the pressure on.
We had a case of a Lithuanian priest that my husband was the coordinator for. He was in a gulag for, I believe it was 21 years. We wrote letters and wrote letters and phoned the embassy from time to time. We got Mrs. Martin Luther King to write a letter on his behalf. Anytime Russian delegations came to Portland, we would go and try to talk to them. And it seemed as if he became more trouble inside than outside. And that was a particularly satisfying case because he came to visit us in Portland a few years later.
Jane and Chris's son is Nicholas Christoph, a well-known columnist for the New York Times, who has been very vocal about the genocide in Darfur. The Portland chapter has followed suit.
We were very much targeting American officials, the president, our senators, and our congressmen and so forth. But now the U.S. Has really become more responsive on Darfur. So we've also written to Egyptian officials, but we've been urging them to intervene in the situation or to bring pressure on the situation. In general, we write to whoever we can think of. We've, of course, written to the Sudan also.
Group 48 is constantly looking for new volunteers.
They should go to the Native American Center on the PSU campus the second Friday of every month. We have a meeting there. 7 o'clock is really the social hour and signing petitions and this kind of thing. And then 7:30, the official meeting starts. Everyone reports on their activity and matters of general interest are discussed.
Jane also had some advice for people who want to get into the human rights field.
My advice would be to remember that even if it doesn't seem as if you're making a difference, you probably are. I remember when I was cleaning out my computer, I had all these letters to Gorbachev, you know, in the Soviet Union about Father Sprinskas. And by the time I was cleaning up the computer, Gorbachev was no longer in charge. There was no Soviet Union, and Father Sprinskas was a legislator in Lithuania.
Reporting for KBOO, this is Aaron Ernst.
This Friday at 4 p.m., Amnesty International hosts a rally at Pioneer Square to denounce torture. To hear more from our series on local human rights activists, visit the KBOO News archives at www.kboo.fm.
This Friday night is the Portland State University Association of African Students Awards Night. Live in the studio with us right now, we have two students from that association, Kamer and Akberet. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Okay, first off, can you tell us a little bit about what's happening on Friday night?
Friday night is a celebration where there'll be African performances, so the Portland community can get involved with the Africans,
Basically, the main point for doing this is actually called the 26th Annual African Culture Night. It's titled as in My Africa. It's a celebration for all Africans in the community of Portland as well as the Portland State. We do this annually at the Ballroom Smith Center as well. And it's basically for a celebration as performance dancers from different parts of African groups that perform. And there's going to be some singers, including Nigerian drummers as well as Somalis and South Africans. And who else am I missing, okay?
Guinea. The Pacific Islanders, Eritreans, and Wulong dancers, and we have a keynote speaker, Dr. Yes. Dipo Sabobaham.
Yes.
Great. So can you tell us about the Association of African Students? What does your group do, and who participates in it?
What we do is that since we want the African community to get involved, we recruit members. Our main goal is to recruit African members, but anyone can join. And as officers, we try to set events that will gather African community students, African students, to bring them as one, just to know one another, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Share
one another experiences and cultures. And this is not the only event we have. We have other small events, but this is the biggest we have, though.
Great. So Portland is considered one of the whitest cities in the United States, and right now there's an influx of refugees from the African continent to the Portland area. What are some of the issues that Africans are facing in coming to Oregon? Is that a tough question for you?
Let's see.
That is definitely a tough question. I would say, are we talking about students directly or in general just African communities?
Let's talk about African community. Are you finding a lot of stereotyping? And what would that look like? I mean, what are some of the stereotypes that Americans or even Oregonians may have of Africa that may not be correct?
Actually, the reason why we call this year My Africa is kind of, we know that the media has this African they see as in jungle or the animals mostly associated with, and the stereotypes, you know, and we call it My Africa, so we know that Africa is not a country, and every part of Africa is extremely different, you know, even within the country itself, in one country. They all have their own little languages and everything going on. So we wanted to share all of our experiences and all that. And I don't understand people, you know, I don't think people understand that there's many different parts into it to Africa, not just as in
the stereotypes.
Right. The stereotypes of what the media kind of sees as.
Many different cultures.
Exactly.
Very diverse.
Very.
Thank you. So for one more time, tell us about your event this Friday and how can we get involved in your organization?
Well, you can get involved by coming to the event and watching our performances and learning, asking questions. And also, you also can get involved by keeping in touch with us, which are Portland State, and our number is 503-725-5659, or email us at african_aas@yahoo.com.
And what time is your event on Friday night?
6 p.m. till midnight.
Great.
Or 11 p.m., sorry.
Great. Thank you. That was Kamir and Akberet from the Association of African Students at Portland State University. PSU's 26th Annual African Cultural Night is this Friday at Smith Memorial Ballroom. That's in room 338. Tickets are available at Ticketmaster. For information, call 503-725-5659.
Living near the Hanford Nuclear Reservation does not appear to increase cancer deaths, according to a new study published in the journal Health Physics. The study looked at the number of cancer deaths in Benton, Franklin, Adams, and Walla Walla counties from 1950 through 2000. The study compares cancer rates in the four counties near Hanford, where radiation exposure is believed to have been the greatest, to five other counties not downwind from Hanford. The only statistical significant difference in cancer rates between the Hanford counties and the control counties was a lower rate of lung cancer deaths for those near Hanford. The study said that may be because people near Hanford were less likely to smoke cigarettes. The study found 33 thyroid cancer deaths in the Hanford counties compared to 76 deaths in the control counties, which had a larger population.
Washington State Congressman Norm Dix says two Seawolf-class attack submarines will be based at Bremerton. The Seawolf and Connecticut are moving from Groton, Connecticut in the summer of 2007 as part of a realignment of naval forces from the East Coast. The shift will put 60% of the Navy's submarine fleet in the Pacific. The third Seawolf-class sub, the Jimmy Carter, moved last year to the Bangor submarine base about 20 miles north of Bremerton on Hood Canal. The Seawolf subs are 353 feet long and carry a crew of 140. Each costs $2.5 billion to build at the shipyard in Groton. They can dive to more than 800 feet and carry 50 torpedoes or missiles. 11 other subs, including Tritons, are based at Bangor. The Seawolf subs will join the aircraft carrier Stennis in making Bremerton their home port.
The parents of seven developmentally disabled students have filed a claim against Clover Park School District in Washington State. The claim alleges the students were physically abused, called names, and received an inadequate education. The parents say staff members, parents, and students serving as teacher assistants witnessed the mistreatment, most of which allegedly occurred at special education classes at Lakes High School. The claim was filed this month. If a settlement is not reached, the parents' attorney said they will sue. The lawsuit would seek at least $12 million and likely seek a court order requiring the districts to prevent discrimination against special education students. District officials say they could not talk about specific allegations raised by the parents, but in a written response said they and police investigated some of them, taking action when appropriate but finding no merits in others. The district says it will investigate new allegations it learned of, through the parents' claim.
The Squim Washington School Board told the police department to keep looking for a new station. The board turned down a proposal to move the station into a wing of the community school, the same building as the alternative high school. The police station is now housed in a strip mall in Squim.
current time is 5:20. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News. There won't be any criminal charges over alleged paperwork fraud by government scientists on the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste dump. The World Bank has been accused of faking figures and wasting money on ineffective medicines in its malaria treatment program. And New York's Transit Workers Union members are holding a round-the-clock vigil outside the jail where their president, Roger Toussaint, is serving a 10-day sentence for December's strike. You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO, in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
There won't be any criminal charges over alleged paperwork fraud by government scientists on the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste dump. The Energy Department's Inspector General says today it concluded a criminal investigation in December, but the United States Attorney for the District of Nevada declined to prosecute. No word today about that decision from Daniel Bogdan, the U.S. Attorney in Las Vegas. At issue were emails that the U.S. Geological Survey employees exchanged between 1998 and 2000, suggesting government hydrologists falsified quality assurance documentation at the repository about 90 miles northwest of Las Vegas. The Energy Department has since concluded that scientific work on the project was not jeopardized, but the work's being redone anyway.
New York's Transit Workers Union members are holding a round-the-clock vigil outside the jail where their president, Roger Toussaint, is serving a 10-day sentence for December's strike. FSRN's Rebecca Miles reports from New York City.
This is a very important day for labor in this city. It's a tragedy what's happening to this man, and I support him 100%. We're going to make sure that he's safe while he's in jail. We're going to take care of him.
That was Benny Basio from the Correction Officers Benevolent Union on Brooklyn Bridge yesterday afternoon, accompanying Roger Toussaint as he headed to the Tombs, the city jail, for breaking the Taylor Law when he organized a strike by the Transport Workers Union in December. Toussaint will spend 10 days in jail. Contract negotiations stalled in December over pensions, pay increases and health benefits, leading to a three-day transit strike. The TWU is found guilty of breaking the Taylor Law, which prohibits public employees from striking. As a result, the union has been fined $2.5 million and has been prevented from collecting union dues via paycheck deductions. John Rodriguez is an organizer with the Laborers Union Local 731. He says there's an apathy on behalf of white-collar workers about the importance of what unions are fighting for throughout the country.
The lack of solidarity comes from the current white-collar worker not understanding the movement, not understanding what this country was built on, not understanding how this country was built and who it was built by.
Standing outside the Bernard B. Carrick complex, New York City's jail, Roger Toussaint said, "We are living in a country where workers' rights are being eroded daily."
I stand here today because the judge has found me guilty of contempt of court. The truth of the matter is that I have nothing but contempt for a system that gives employers free rein to abuse workers. This is not an attack on Roger Toussaint as an individual, but an attack on the membership of Local 100 and on all working people in this city. I am here because the entire labor movement is being told to abandon the idea that a militant trade union can fight back, if necessary, to protect the lives and the security of our membership. All over the United States, workers are being asked to accept declining standards of living, an end to pensions, reductions in health care, and speed ups in productivity. At the same time, the pay and benefits for corporate managers is exploding upward. The era of relative equality in America is ending. Should we sit still and watch?
There is a monthly meeting of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority later today, but for now the contract dispute remains unresolved and Roger Toussaint is in jail. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
The multi-million dollar lobbying effort to repeal the federal estate tax has been aggressively led by 18 super wealthy families. according to a report released today by Public Citizen and United for a Fair Economy at a press conference in Washington, D.C. The report details for the first time the vast money, influence, and deceptive marketing techniques behind the rhetoric in the campaign to repeal the tax. It reveals how 18 families worth a total of $185.5 billion have financed and coordinated a 10-year effort to repeal the estate tax, a move that would collectively net them a windfall of $71.5 billion. The report, available at www.citizen.org, profiles the families and their businesses, which include the families behind Walmart, Gallo Wine, Campbell's Soup, and Mars Incorporated, maker of M&Ms. Collectively, the list includes the first and third largest privately held companies in the United States, the richest family in Alabama, and the world's largest retailer.
The Senate is debating the emergency supplemental budget that the president requested for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and for Hurricane Katrina recovery. As FSRN's Leigh Ann Caldwell reports, this is an opportunity for lawmakers to include a variety of agenda items they deem important.
The supplemental introduced in the Senate totaled nearly $107 billion. That's $15 billion more than what the president requested and that passed the House of Representatives. As of now, the legislation includes $67 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, $27 billion for Hurricane Katrina recovery, and the remainder will go toward other security-related programs, including $2 billion for the avian flu. Funding the war through an emergency supplemental is not an emergency to some. Democratic Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia speaking on the Senate floor.
The failure of the president to heed the repeated calls by the Senate to budget for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan has resulted in more unnecessary spending that is hidden.
This will be the fourth supplemental for the war since it began 3 years ago. It will also bring the total cost of this year's defense budget to more than $500 billion. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist told reporters that he will bring the cost of that supplemental back down to its original request of $92 billion. He will do that by doing away with, quote, excessive projects. One project that could be considered as unnecessary is the transfer of a newly laid railroad track in Mississippi that would cost $500 million. The supplemental is also an opportunity for lawmakers to include provisions they call urgent. Possible amendments include immigration, Iraq war policy, and gas prices. The first amendment offered by Senator Bill Frist is a $2 billion border security offset to increase the number of Border Patrol agents. Meanwhile, the Democrats plan to focus a supplemental on the rising gas prices, with amendments that are not yet fleshed out. Democratic Whip Richard Durbin from Illinois.
He said, the prices at the pump reflect our addiction to oil. No, Mr. President. What you're talking about are consumers who have no choice in the matter. They have these cars and trucks that unfortunately become much more expensive to operate. That isn't their fault. It's the fault of the oil companies. And the oil companies have shown that the prices at the pump reflect their greed and the lack of leadership by this administration.
Senator Carl Levin, Democrat from Wisconsin, introduced with two co-sponsors a resolution that would make conditional the ability of the Iraqi government to meet constitutional deadlines of forming a government with the participation of American troops. Democrat Jack Reed from Rhode Island, one of the co-sponsors.
Our troop presence is to be dictated by the conditions on the ground. But what this amendment says is that the Iraqi leaders have to help shape those conditions on the ground by taking appropriate political action, by cooperating with us in establishing the security forces, that this is not a American effort alone.
Senator Levin is confident the mainstream Shia, the Sunnis, and the Kurds all want the Americans to stay in Iraq for the time being. Republican Senator Susan Collins from Maine, another co-sponsor, responded when FSRN asked if this resolution would keep troops in Iraq longer in the instance that deadlines are met.
Other people in the Senate and elsewhere have proposed a hard deadline for starting to withdraw our troops. That is not what we're saying. What we're saying is that the Iraqis need to meet their own deadlines. We need a political solution in Iraq.
They say the president has never put political pressure on the Iraqi government, but rather, they say, he tells the Iraqis the U.S. will be patient. Lawmakers critical of the war in Iraq are likely to not oppose the emergency supplemental. FSRN asked Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer from California if she will vote in favor of the war supplemental.
Well, I would say to Pacifica's listeners that there may be funds in there to really help our veterans mentally, help them physically, get them to come home sooner. So I don't think anyone should make a decision about how they're going to vote on a supplemental that hasn't even left the floor yet.
Senator Boxer is seeking funding for levees in California that are in need of repair and for mental health services for veterans. The Senate is expected to debate the supplemental all week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ann Caldwell.
President Bush announced several measures today aimed to ease skyrocketing gasoline prices. Matt Kay reports from Washington, D.C.
Bush announced a short-term suspension of deposits in the U.S. oil reserve, waivers on certain fuel additives, and a push to get Congress to repeal $2 billion in oil tax breaks over 10 years. But a move to speed up refinery permitting could also ease clean air rules.
To make this gasoline supply more affordable and more secure, Congress needs to allow refiners to make modifications on their refineries without having to wait for years to get their idea approved. I mean, if we want more supply, let's reduce the paperwork and the regulations.
Democrats generally oppose relaxing pollution rules that seized on record oil company profits as corporate greed and propose a windfall profits tax Bush opposes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Kay in Washington.
A federal terrorism trial in California has ended in a mistrial. A Lodi man, Umar Hayat, was charged with lying to FBI agents about whether his son attended an al-Qaeda training camp in 2003 in Pakistan. A court official in Sacramento says the jury declared itself hopelessly deadlocked this morning. The 48-year-old ice cream vendor had faced up to 16 years in prison on both counts related to lying to federal agents. His son stood trial before a separate jury, which is still deliberating. The informer was Nasim Khan, a Pakistani immigrant who lived in Bend, Oregon, and was recruited by the FBI while working in a convenience store. The 23-year-old defendant is charged with providing material support to terrorists and three counts of lying about the camp visit. If convicted on all charges, he could get up to 39 years in prison.
A South Central farm in Los Angeles has until May 22nd to raise $1 million to satisfy the purchase price demanded by land developer Rolf Horowitz. KFPK's Kelly Barnes reports.
Negotiations brokered by the Trust for Public Land between the farmers, the city, and Horowitz have opened a hopeful window of opportunity in a tentative purchase agreement that may allow the community to buy the land outright. Farmers at the nation's largest urban garden have just under 4 weeks to raise an additional $1 million on top of at least $10 million they've already raised. The Trust for Public Land vowed to make up any difference at the conclusion of community fundraising. The final price agreed to by the negotiators is not known, but Horowitz had previously demanded a sum of $16 million, which the developer claimed was below market value. Horowitz paid $5 million for the property 3 years ago. The garden has been locked in a 3-year battle whereby Horowitz aimed to evict the farmers in order to build another warehouse in the industrial district. Organizers say our voices have been heard, the vibrations from our marching feet have been felt, and the power of the community has been acknowledged. For FSRN, this is Kelly Barnes in LA.
For the pain of losing an eye and going through 21 operations since she was maimed by a blast at an abortion clinic, Emily Lyons has gotten all she ever expects to receive from the bomber, Eric Rudolph, $57.69. Lyons was among the first victims to receive a share of the $2.3 million in restitution that Rudolph was ordered to pay after pleading guilty last year in a string of crimes that included the Birmingham clinic attack and the Atlanta Olympics bombing. While Lyons laughs at the amount she received, right now it's a tank and a little more gas, she said Monday others view the paltry payments as a disgrace. Diane Derzies, owner of the clinic that was bombed in 1998 in an attack that also killed a police officer, received $38.42. John Hawthorne, whose wife Alice was killed in the Olympics bombing in 1996, is still waiting for his. Rudolph, who is serving 4 life terms for the Birmingham and Atlanta attacks and 2 other bombings in Atlanta in 1997, is indigent, officials said.
A group of military mothers in California urged state lawmakers this morning to adopt new legislation keeping protesters away from funerals for fallen soldiers. Members of the Blue Star Mom Support Group are presenting before a state assembly committee in Sacramento. The legislation was spurred by protests from a Kansas-based church that claims soldiers are dying because God is punishing the United States for sinful behaviors. The new law would keep protesters 300 feet away from all funerals and memorial services and would apply to demonstrators with any message, not just an anti-war one. Violators would face up to $1,000 in fines and 6 months in jail. Opponents say the law would violate free speech. 32 other states are considering similar measures. At least 9 have enacted similar laws.
Maine's governor has signed a bill strengthening policy on labor and human rights tied to the state's purchase of apparel. The governor is also reaching out to other governors to join in an independent monitoring coalition. Meredith DeFrancesco from WERU in Blue Hill, Maine, reports.
Maine's legislature has just passed a bill that strengthens the implementation of Maine's ethical purchasing policy, which has sought to address the use of sweatshop labor in the manufacturing of apparel used by the state government. In 2002, Maine became the first state in the country to pass a sweat-free procurement bill requiring companies selling textiles to the state to sign an affidavit stipulating that their supplier factories adhered to international labor standards. Many states, cities, and schools have followed in what now is a growing movement for public accountability for sweatshop-produced goods. LD 1769, an act to strengthen Maine's purchasing code of conduct, instructs the State Division of Purchasing to demand manufacturers comply with independent monitoring, work with them to remedy any violations, and to cancel contracts with uncooperative companies. Cynthia Finney is with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and is a former shoe worker in Maine.
This is an important step in terms of globalization, making sure that workers aren't pitted against each other for who will submit to slavery and below legal standard work, because this ensures that as Maine workers, our Maine tax dollars aren't paying to support sweatshops for vendors who aren't even following what laws they have in the countries where they're working.
In a parallel effort, Maine's Governor John Baldacci has taken the initiative to send out a letter to all state governors to join efforts and finances to engage in independent monitoring through a consortium, much in the same way universities have been doing. The governor hopes states will support each other's efforts and make it easier for other states to engage in sweat-free policies.
Maine is very proud of being able to take this leadership role. It protects workers. It protects our industries here in America and in the state of Maine. It recognizes the quality of that work. And it sends a message to other states that, you know, to join forces, because together we collectively have the economic purchasing power that's enormous.
Bjorn Skorpen Claussen was active in the formation of Maine's policy while working with the Bangor Clean Clothes Campaign. He is now the co-coordinator of the national networking organization, Sweat Free Communities.
This market belongs to us because governments use our money, our tax dollars, which means that we as a people can create the rules for this market, and we can make sure that this market operates in accordance with our values, and we can make sure that companies don't get access to this market, that companies don't get public contracts unless they actually operate in accordance with some basic fair labor standard.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Meredith DeFrancesco at WERU in Blue Hill, Maine.
It's 5:38 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Bush political operative Karl Rove is a Machiavellian master at finding divisive, hot-button election year issues that delight the GOP's right-wing barn burners, divide the Democrats, and divert voters' attention from such realities as falling wages, poor health care, and war. For this fall's electoral battle, Karl thought he had the perfect scapegoat, illegal immigrants. But look out, Carl. This flamethrower of an issue has blown back on you. By pushing a vengeful anti-immigrant bill through the House, the Bushites have indeed rallied the xenophobic right, but they also got something they never expected. A massive outpouring of outrage from immigrants of all kinds, as well as from young people, the clergy, union members, moderate Republicans, and just plain folks. Carl awakened, alienated, and activated a huge constituency that he wrongly assumed was too meek and powerless to stand up. Rove's strategy of divisiveness requires that an issue be boneheaded simple. He thought he had it with immigration. See illegal workers, deport, build wall, everything good again. But as made clear by millions of people taking to the streets, it's not so simple. However, Republicans are not the only ones who could learn something from these mass demonstrations. Democrats in Congress and those planning to run for president also had no idea that this dormant constituency was there, was so passionate, and was ready to fire up. If Democratic leaders will grow a backbone, break out of the clubby confines of corporate politics, and reassert their party's populist ideals, they'll find that millions of Americans who've been shunted aside by the system are ready to respond to a new politics that appeals directly and honestly to their long-ignored hopes and needs. This is Jim Hightower saying this would be an opportune time for Democrats to start reaching out to the workaday majority of people who've been getting kicked by the Republicans for so long. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Out Loud, followed by Prison Pipeline with host Reggae Bob at 6:30. At 7, it's Clemmie's Grooves. Tonight's weather in Portland, partly cloudy this evening with more clouds for overnight, low of 47. Expect to see a few passing clouds over Hood River, otherwise generally clear with a low of 44. Tonight in Corvallis, partly to mostly cloudy, low 44 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies in Portland, high near 65. Hood River will see intervals of clouds and sunshine, high of 66. In Corvallis, mostly cloudy skies early, then partly cloudy in the afternoon, a high of 69. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
British police warned today that the illegal smuggling of women and children into the UK for prostitution has reached epidemic levels. From London, Helen Kelly has more.
Organised criminal gangs are getting away with trafficking thousands of women and children into the UK for sexual exploitation each year, a senior Scotland Yard officer told the BBC this morning. Police warn they are losing the battle against these gangs, which have set up fake passport franchises with which to smuggle people into the country. The gangs are also known to engage in other crimes, from serious fraud to drug trafficking. Detective Chief Inspector Bob Murrell of Scotland Yard described the problem as a 21st century slave trade and said the scale of these crimes was daunting. Since 2000, there have been several anti-trafficking initiatives launched in the UK, including longer jail sentences and increased international cooperation. Operation Maxim, set up by Scotland Yard to combat immigration crime, is overwhelmed. Police admit they only deal with a small percentage of cases, the majority of offences remaining undetected. Helen Kelly, reporting from London for Free Speech Radio.
A boat carrying around 20 Dominican migrants has capsized, killing at least 5 people. At least 13 people aboard the makeshift 14-foot wooden boat survives the capsizing off the shores of Rincon, near the western tip of Puerto Rico. Small boats frequently carrying migrants trying to enter the United States illegally from the Dominican Republic to Puerto Rico. Many have died trying to make the treacherous journey across the rough waters of the Moña Passage, which runs between the two countries.
Leftist President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela said yesterday he would greatly expand the discounted home heating oil program he started last year for needy people in Massachusetts and other northeastern states. Chavez, a firebrand populist who has clashed repeatedly with President Bush, said in an interview with the Boston Globe that he would extend the program for next year and increase the amount of cheaper oil available. Former U.S. Representative Joseph P. Kennedy II, who was among a group that negotiated the deal with Chavez, said customers would have more direct access to the heating oil and would be subject to looser eligibility rules. Chavez made the pledge in an interview after meeting with a group including Representative William D. Delahunt, Democrat of Quincy, and Kennedy, who is now chairman of Citizens Energy, a nonprofit Massachusetts group. The two had played a key role in negotiating the initial deal with Chavez last year that sent 12 million gallons of reduced-cost heating oil to Bay Staters this winter, which assisted about 45,000 needy families. Several other states negotiated similar deals.
Panama has announced a $5.3 billion plan to expand the Panama Canal to handle bigger cargo ships. Around 40 ships a day pass through the 80-kilometer canal, which links the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans and plays a vital role in global trade. The canal's capacity has now become stretched, partly because of surging exports from China. The canal was opened in 1914 and run by the U.S. until it was handled handed back to the Panama government in 1999.
This week marks the 20th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, which sent a radioactive cloud from Belarus through Europe, bringing with it death, cancer, and genetic abnormalities. As the current global political climate of tense discussions are about nuclear power and weapons persists, the people of Belarus are still living and dying with the consequences of the disaster. Over the weekend, over 150 young people from 20 different countries gathered in Berlin for the Youth Energy Summit. Among them were 10 young delegates from Belarus. They came to talk about their experiences living day to day in a nuclear fallout zone. Free Speech Radio News' Cinnamon Nippard reports from Berlin.
When did you first hear about the Chernobyl disaster?
I think probably when I was 12 or so in school.
And what did you hear about it?
Well, my mom actually told me about it, too. That she was very worried because she was just pregnant with me, and everyone was very worried about everything, and no children could play outside.
I hear it's something that has happened, and there are people that affected, and I knew from my childhood that we also were affected in a way because the cloud radiation just 86, I was 3 years old, but I know about kids born then had some, there were some cases of some deformations.
22-year-old Serge lives in a city 140 kilometres from Chernobyl. Life is hard for people living in contaminated areas. Health problems like cancer and genetic deformities are normal, and despite warnings, villagers grow and eat local produce or collect mushrooms and berries from the forest, which are highly radioactive. For some, imported produce is too expensive, while others refuse to buy things when they can grow or collect it themselves.
There are some foodstuffs which are accumulators of radiation, and the so-called leader of accumulating is mushrooms. Sometimes they contain radiations 100 times as much than the norm. All forest gifts contain, they are accumulators of radiation, and of course fish, meat, and what is the worst, milk, because milk are necessary for children, and they drink it, and they get 60% of the radiation out of milk.
Many people in Belarus still live in areas affected by radiation because they are too poor to move, or are too old and don't want to change their lives. Others, like doctors and teachers, are posted to contaminated areas by the government.
Our government pays money to those who live in Chernobyl zone, but people spend this money on products, locally produced products, polluted. So it's no use of this money. So people who get it call this money funeral money, because it's only useful for buying coffin or something like that.
Given that the people of Belarus are still feeling the effects of radiation, it seems unthinkable that their government would consider building another nuclear power plant. But those cards are on the table. As Russia hikes up gas prices, the government of Belarus is looking for alternative energy sources for its people. For Free Speech Radio News in Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
The World Bank has been accused of faking figures and wasting money on ineffective medicines in its malaria treatment program. A study by 13 international public health experts published in The Lancet claims the bank gave false accounts to boost the success of its malaria projects and funded obsolete treatments going against expert advice. It also claims the bank went back on a pledge to invest millions of dollars in Africa. The bank has denied the allegations and says it is investing between $500 million and $1 billion over the next 5 years.
Three people have been arrested in connection with the triple bombing in the Red Sea resort of Dahab that killed at least 23 people. Egyptian authorities are trying to establish whether the explosions were caused by suicide bombers or bombs on timers. Three foreigners were killed and 62 injured in Monday's blast. The attack is a third against tourist resorts along Egypt's Red Sea coast in the past 2 years. In July of 2005, 70 people were killed in multiple bombings in the southern Sinai resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. The Egyptian authorities attributed those attacks to a small Sinai-based group founded by a militant Islamic of Palestinian origin.
Human rights activists have joined survivors of Gurajat, India's 2002 sectarian violence, who are fighting for justice in courts against alleged government-supported rioters. Victims' families have dug up some of their loved ones' remains and now say the state is trying to harass and intimidate them. FSRN's Binu Alex has more from Ahmedabad.
The ghost of 2002 Hindu-Muslim sectarian violence seems to be following both the accused and the victims of Gujarat. Human rights activists accused the government of tacitly supporting the rioters to subvert justice and harassing the victims. In March of 2002, more than 2,000 Muslims were killed. Many of those bodies haven't been found until now. Relatives are finding human remains in many places in central Gujarat. Victims are finding it hard to live in the villages as their fellow Hindu villagers have stopped dealing with them, signaling that they should withdraw the case. To escape accountability for the illegal and unauthorized burial of bodies of victims, the government says Teesta Sethalwat, co-founder of Citizens for Justice and Peace, an organization fighting for riot victims, is trying to intimidate them.
It's nothing short of a desire to victimize and terrorize victim survivors and human rights defenders who are assisting those victims. Whenever victims try and fight for justice, they are being given a condition, economic boycott, social boycott. So the message is clear from the Gujarat administration, you can't have justice and coexist. I mean, what kind of message is this in a democracy?
Since 2002, the Gujarat government has blamed what they sarcastically call English-speaking media and high-flying five-star activists of defaming the state for personal gains. Ashok Bhatt is the law minister of Gujarat.
These are allegations by those who have no other agenda but to defame the Gujarat province.
The case relates to some 40 persons who were slaughtered in central Gujarat on March 1, 2002, the day after a train coach was allegedly burnt by Muslim mob, killing 58 Hindu activists. A case was registered, and for lack of evidence, the accused were acquitted in November 2002. But the police could not locate the bodies. In the month of December 2005, they were tipped off by a nomad about a possible mass grave where it was dug up in the presence of media and fellow villagers. They called the police immediately, but instead of helping them, the police charged relatives with illegal digging of what they termed as a cemetery, which was actually a forest area. It was then that these relatives filed a case against police authorities that same week for illegally burying the relatives. Anticipating trouble, the government issued arrest warrants against those who filed the cases to apparently silence them. Activists say it's a threat against speaking out. They were charged under Section 295 of the Indian Constitution. Again, Teesta Sethalwat.
What is 295? Inflaming religious sentiments. Of whom? I have lost my family members. I am looking for the remains. I find those remains. I quietly, in the presence of the media, because I've lost faith in the administration, try and go to a spot and dig them out. When I find something, I stop. I inform the police. Whose sentiments am I damaging if I'm just retrieving the bodies of my lost ones?
But the High Court stayed the government warrants and has also directed the Gujarat police not to initiate action against these victims on a plea by Teesta. As the cases drag on, many in the public are confused about the proceedings. Vijay Tendulkar is a theatre personality and chairperson for Citizens for Justice and Peace.
And in fact, it is getting more muddled, more dangerous, disturbing. And at this point, someone like me, who doesn't know law that much, cannot fathom what is going to be the end of all this.
Tendulkar once said and still says that if he had a gun, he would have shot Narendra Modi, the chief minister of Gujarat, blamed by various rights organizations as the architect of the violence. Modi is regaining political power and is expected to return to office in the next elections due in a couple of years' time. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 25th, 2006. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on Translator K26AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock Revis. Our assistant producer is Jim Thompson. Tonight's audio editor is Lisa Loving. Our special thanks to reporters Kirsten Flagg and Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Laurie Hilliard.
And I'm Doug Guidi. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. And at 7:30 a.m. on Locus Focus Talk Radio, the Whole Communities Radio Project presents a panel discussion on the environmental consequences of dying and sustainable approaches to death and its aftermath. At 9, it's Movie Talk with Ed, DK, and Don on the latest movies. At 9:30, Laurie Sonnenfeld hosts Speaking of Animals. At 10, Andrew Geller hosts People Rise Up. The topic is the future of the Internet. At 10:30, Aaron Yankee and Icky A interview experimental filmmaker Bill Daniel about his documentary film, Who is Bozo Texino?, which will show as part of the PDX Film Festival. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO. Good night, and thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 25th of April. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In southwestern Ontario, the standoff between the Ontario Provincial Police and Aboriginals from the Six Nations Reserve took another turn last night when a peaceful rally escalated. Reporter Mark Barrowcliffe from CKRZ News is at the rally in Caledonia, speaking from a cell phone at the site.
The crowd started a few chants with go home and open our road. And then they started to push the OPP line. The OPP line grew and grew as they called in more OPP to stand in between the Native protesters on the Douglas Creek Estate side and the Caledonia residents who were trying to push in to open their road.
Last Thursday, about 16 protesters were arrested during a pre-dawn raid by the OPP. Members of the Six Nation Reserve say the disputed housing project is on Native land and have been occupying the site peacefully for more than 3 months. Barrowcliffe says last night's rally was supposed to encourage resolution.
As far as I know, the rally was supposed to be about getting the government to act upon the land claims and bring a quick resolve to this. And that was the first speech. It was about the Canadian government. It was, we pay our taxes, we want our government to do something, we want the OPP to do something. And then, a few people from the crowd got up on the stage and were shouting out different things like, stop paying your taxes, and let's just go down there, let's open our road. And then the crowd got more and more confrontational with each other, some people in support of the Native protesters, and some people that just wanted to go down and open the road. Eventually, the crowd gathered at the site on Argyle Street, and eventually the crowd got more angry, and then they started to push the OPP line back, and now a gap that was about 400 yards is close to about 150. And the so far on the Native protester side, they haven't said a word, they haven't been agitating anyone, they've been silent, and right now the standoff continues.
That was Mark Barrowcliffe from CKRZ News, speaking from a cell phone in Caledonia, Ontario. Meanwhile, in South Dakota, the president of the Pine Ridge Reservation has vowed to build an abortion clinic in the wake of a statewide abortion ban. The move is causing some internal controversy as tribal residents grapple with the issue. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Charles Michael Ray has the story.
Earlier this year, South Dakota passed the nation's toughest anti-abortion law to date, banning the procedure even in cases of rape and incest. This angered Oglala Sioux Tribal President Cecilia Firethunder.
To me, if a woman who's been sexually assaulted finds herself pregnant and she makes a decision to terminate that pregnancy caused by violence, that's her choice. I don't know where the state legislatures were thinking.
But Firethunder may be up against a tribal law that bans abortion. Patrick Lee, a former chief judge for the Oglala Sioux Tribe, says the law has been on the books for many years and is actually more strict than the abortion ban recently passed by the state.
In my opinion, the tribal cultural value of respect for life is embodied in Section 102 of the Juvenile Code, which deems an unborn child as an existing person. the respect for life is reflected in that ordinance, in my opinion.
Fire Thunder has raised about $10,000 through the internet donations for the clinic so far, but those opposed to her plan are threatening to start impeachment proceedings. Charles Michael Ray, Rapid City, South Dakota.
A new program in Minnesota hopes to break the cycle of poverty by providing loans for people on the White Earth Reservation. The Jumpstart program helps low-income people secure a down payment for a car. Tribal officials are partnering with the program because they say without dependable transportation, it's impossible to get a job, especially if it requires a long commute. So far, 30 people have cars because of the Jumpstart program. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie C. Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976.